Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, July 17th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to gather around the virtual water cooler to talk about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at SlashFilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
Glad that I was able to get you back on the podcast today because, as promised, I wanted to talk with you about the new movie Long Legs, which premiered last week, and you talked about it on last week's episode of the show. I had not had a chance to see it at that point, but I have now seen the movie, and I want to talk to you about a couple things. I guess let's talk about Nick Cage's performance before we talk about the end of the movie. So, like, do you think we can have this discussion without spoiling anything, the Cage performance part?
Yeah, I definitely think we can do that.
Okay, so let's do that. And then we'll put like a clear spoiler warning when we start talking about the ending in case people haven't had a chance to catch up with it yet. So I wanted to say, first of all, like based on the severity of the reactions to this movie, I was expecting to be like utterly petrified the entire time. I thought the movie was incredibly creepy, very unnerving. I ended up loving it. It reminded me a lot of Silence of the Lambs, obviously. I was extremely tense through a lot of it because Oz Perkins, the director, does such a good job of leaving space in the frame where you think somebody might pop out in the background of a shot. That's something you mentioned when you were talking about it last week. And I thought that was like an incredibly effective way to tell this story because the characters just seemed, a lot of times the characters seemed like they were helpless in a way, like they were not looking behind them or, you know, they were not fully aware of their surroundings. And occasionally a character would be there sort of lurking in the background. It was just really, really effective when that stuff happened.
Yeah.
I did think that Nick Cage was a little much in this movie. And part of me feels like it might've been scarier if that character was less like a collection of affectations and was more like a familiar neighbor from down the street. But it's tough because you're trying to make something iconic as a filmmaker. So I understand why they took the approach they did, but I know that you're like a huge fan of this Nick Cage performance. So I wondered if you could talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I'm not like a huge, huge fan. I just wrote a piece for Slash Film. It just went up about whether or not the performance is good. I ultimately fall on the side of it being a good performance. This is partially inspired by anytime there's a new Nick Cage movie lately, people take to Twitter and they air their silly thoughts. And I saw, I'm not going to like name and shame someone, but I saw someone the other day who was like, Nick Cage is a bad actor and people only like him ironically. And that drove me absolutely insane because Nick Cage is not a bad actor. And I get it. I get why some people think that because Nick Cage has made a lot of bad movies. He fell into some trouble with the IRS. He owed them like $6.3 million, and he started taking any role he was offered, and he made a lot of crap. But that doesn't mean he's a bad actor. It just means he needed money. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to sit here and defend every Nick Cage performance. Like, there are times where he's clearly phoning it in, like the movie Left Behind, which is like this religious thriller. He's clearly like just cashing a check, and that's fine. But with this, he's definitely going really big. He's going really over the top, and I can understand why that will not work for some people. And I don't think it's wrong if it doesn't work for you, but I think it just makes the film a lot more interesting to have him be this really weird, over the top strange guy. I say in my write-up that like he seems like a guy who really enjoys his work, and I think Nick Cage is a guy who really enjoys his work too. I think that's sort of the fun in the performance, that he's having fun playing this really whacked out character.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think because the movie, and again, without really spoiling anything about the movie, because the film kind of rides this line of like, how much of it is supernatural? How much of it is actually real? What are we really seeing here? I think that approach to telling this story kind of aligns with what Cage is doing, and aligns with having a villain who is a little bit kind of larger than life in that way. I don't know. I was just trying to think of like, ways that might have that the film and that character specifically might have been like more like chill me to the bone terrifying. And I think there's something about like somebody who is I guess for lack of a better term, like normal, who is capable of doing despicable things, that is that's more realistic and more grounded. And because this movie is a little heightened in spots, I can understand why they made this choice to have the Nick Cage character be heightened as well. So I don't know. I find myself in this weird like middle ground of like certainly respecting the decision and the choices that he made. Like, he's definitely going big in the film, but like also acknowledging that it wasn't as effective for me as it seems to have been for other people. So
yeah.
Anyway, good stuff there. Definitely. All right. Let's talk about the ending of Long Legs. So spoilers for this movie, if you've not seen it yet, this is your final warning. Just fast forward ahead a few minutes. We're going to talk about some other stuff after that. But what did you make of the ending of this movie, Chris? Because I've seen a lot of discussion about it. It seems like fairly divisive.
Yeah. So while I like the movie, I don't think the ending really works very well. When I say the ending, I mean probably like the last maybe 20 or so minutes of the film. And I think a big problem with the ending is everything grinds to a halt so that Alicia Witt's character, who's playing the mother of Michael Moreau's character, the FBI agent trying to figure out what's going on with Long Legs and all this stuff, the movie just grinds to a halt so she can give this really long, drawn out explanation of what's been going on in the movie. And I really don't think we needed that at all. I think we could have easily inferred what was going on, especially like with the last scene, like the last scene where Lee Harker, the FBI agent, shows up at her superior's house. He's possessed and he's about to kill his whole family and all that. Like, we could have, and her mother is there. Like, I think just by doing that, we could have figured out what exactly happened without having the movie like grind to a halt and have her explain what happened and how she has been working with Long Legs. And it's like, we get it. I get it. I also feel like I'm hesitant to go here because I'm not the type of person who needs every little thing spelled out for me. I don't need things to make sense, especially in a movie like this, which is like really leaning into like nightmare logic where, nightmares don't always make sense. That's kind of what makes them scary. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the more you start to think about like Long Legs and his plan, or lack for a better word, it doesn't really make any sense to me. Like, what exactly is Long Legs' plan in this? Like, he makes these dolls, the dolls then possess the entire family somehow. The
movie he's able to like infuse them with the spirit of the devil or something, because he's like literally working with Satan. We see like the one of the, my favorite visuals in the movie appears several times, where like this horned demon shadow creature just sort of subtly appears in the background of different shots. And I think you've mentioned in our Slack, like, oh yeah, you could see the devil in this scene or that scene. And I've been like, what? I didn't even realize the devil was there. Like, I saw it a couple times or whatever. But that's, I think, going to be a fun part about rewatching this movie, is like seeing all the little spots where Oz Perkins sort of snuck that imagery in. So I read that as like him literally just, you know, that's where I was talking about the movie kind of borders on supernatural stuff or whatever, where like it actually in the, within the world of this film, the devil is real and Nick Cage has made a pact with him and like is his servant in some way. And has there's something about the little silver ball that seems to be hollow and empty, and like each one of those appears to be implanted in each one of these dolls as their brain, and it contains this sort of like black smoke stuff that is like the devil incarnate or something. I don't know.
And this is this is my problem with this, because like if the devil is real, as this movie infer, like the devil is, and I'm fine with that. I can accept that in the logic of the movie, that the devil is real and Nicolas Cage's work. Like, why does he need like props? Like, why does the devil need creepy dolls? Like, I it just like the more you start to peel it away, the less like it's just like. And then what exactly is Longlegs' end goal here? Like, I don't understand. Like, I like, all right, he's driving families to kill themselves, but then he just smashes his fucking face in on the table and dies. And it's like, why does he do that? I don't I don't quite get it. And I hate, like, as I say this out loud, I feel like an asshole. Like, I don't want to be one of those nerds who's just like, man, this makes no sense. Because, like, again, I don't need it to make sense, but the more I sit with it, the less like I like how it's handled. Like, like it would make, I feel like it would be more of a thing like if Longlegs drove Lee Harker to shoot him or something like that. Cause like that at least would make sort of sense. Cause like, oh, his plan is to get her to kill him or something like that. But like,
yeah, almost like in Seven or something, right?
Yeah. Like if he could have killed himself literally any time. Like, if that's his plan, to kill himself, why does he have to kill himself at that point in the story? Why does he have to smash his head in front of Lee? Like, I don't understand the point of that. Like, why all of, like, and again, I don't, you know, I appreciate horror movies don't have to spell everything out for me. I don't, you know, but it's just like, I don't know, man. Like, something about that just doesn't sit well with me. Like, it's just like, I feel like the problem is, the movie really wants to have it both ways. It wants to both be a realistic, quote unquote, realistic, like police procedural movie, like Silence of the Lambs. But then it also wants to be supernatural and be like, the devil is real. And he's Nicolas Cage is killing people for the devil. But it's like, again, like, why does the devil, why does the devil want to kill these families? Like, what is the, like, what is the devil's plan here? I just,
and like, yeah, if the devil is real, that's a pretty small scale ambition for the devil to have. It's like over the course of 40 years or whatever to kill, I don't know, 8 families or something. Like, that's your plan, devil, is like slowly, you know, manipulate these families into killing themselves. And like, it's almost like the movie itself realizes that Mike and Monroe's character is the lead of a movie, and that's why the stuff happens at the end, because she's the protagonist of this story. But like, if you take a step back from that and try to zoom out a little bit, like, yeah, the whole like, what is the end game here question, I have no answer to that whatsoever.
I feel like the movie doesn't either, and I feel like that's a flaw. I really do. I feel like even if it doesn't make sense, the movie should have a better conclusion than it has. I don't know. I really don't think they needed the dolls. I feel like the dolls is my sticking point here, because like, the dolls are creepy, but I just keep going back to the idea of like, why does the devil need props, man? Why does the devil need these spooky dolls? Also, what fucking family would like be like, ooh, a doll that looks exactly like our daughter. If someone showed up at my house and was like, here's a doll that looks like your kid, I'd be like, get off my fucking I don't care if it's a nun. Like, I'd be like, get out of here. What are you like, I get that it's set in the past and people were different back then. and people were less suspicious than they are now. But I don't know. Like, again, I hate saying this stuff. I really do, because I hate trying to apply real world logic to this supernatural story. Because, like, but I also feel like if it was a better movie, I wouldn't have these questions. Like, when I watch The Exorcist, I don't stop and think, like, why is the demon possessing this girl? I completely go along with the movie.
Right.
Because that movie is successful in playing by its own rules. And I feel like that's sort of my problem here, is that Long Legs, like, it sets up a certain list of rules and it doesn't really play by them. It's almost like it's cheating to get to its ending. And I kind of have an issue with that. Overall, I like the movie. I think it's got an amazing atmosphere. It's creepy. Everyone's doing really good work here. Blair Underwood is really good. Like, this made me like, I was like, damn, Blair Underwood should be in more movies. He's really good in this movie.
Yeah.
But I really have trouble with, like, I feel like everything up until like the last 20 minutes, I'm 100% on board with. And then it sort of loses me, which bums me out, because I really wanted to love this.
Yeah, I have to say, I was not super bothered by it in the theater, but as we talk it out now, those issues are becoming a little bit more glaring for me, and I'm kind of like spinning out a little bit, being like, hey, wait a second, what's going on here? I will say, I actually appreciated the Alicia Witt montage sequence, because the movie is kind of elliptical in some ways, so I actually did appreciate like having the movie hold my hand and walk me through what happened here, because I don't know... I mean, I think because you've seen a lot more horror stuff than I am, and you're like definitely more on that wavelength, but you said that you might be able to just like intuit by having, you know, cutting that part out and like just arriving at the Blair Underwood character's family home and like seeing that Alicia Wood is there, you'd be able to like sort of put the pieces together and realize that's what's been happening to all these other families. I don't know if I would have been able to make that jump, because the movie is just, I don't know. I guess the word elliptical keeps coming up in my head, where it is a little kind of slippery at times in terms of like what's actually happening. So I appreciated them pausing the movie, and as you say, and kind of explaining all that and laying all that out, because I thought it was just another opportunity to see more of Alicia Witt do her thing. And she's very good in this movie, so I appreciate it on that level too.
Yeah.
But once you get into like, what's the end game here? What's going on? Like, why exactly is Michael Monroe's character, so Lee important. Harker? Yeah. What is it about her that is that seems to be like, the thing around which everything else revolves? Like, see that, like, she is kind of like a little psychic, maybe, and like, does that have anything to do with it? I don't know.
I feel like, again, the movie could have solved this by making her his first victim, but the movie makes it clear that's not the case. Like, he first meets her character in the 70s, and they say like he started killing back in the 60s. So it's like, if this was like the first time he went to kill a family, and then he found this little girl, and then he found this woman to help him, like, that would make more sense, but it's not. So it's like, again, why is she so, like, the only reason she's important is because she's our main character. That's like, and again, that's like, that's movie logic. That's not like quote unquote real world logic. And like, it just, I don't know, man. Like, the whole, like, when I saw the movie, I dug it. And then, like, my whole drive home, all these thoughts are popping in my head. Where I'm just like, wait a minute. Like, why did this happen? Why did that happen? I really actually want to watch it again, because now that, like, I really do think the hype sort of played a factor in here, because this movie has been very hyped up. Like, Neon has been screening this since, like, I want to say like May they started screening this, and like it didn't come out until July, but like they started really early screenings in like April or May for certain people, and they've been slowly screening it in certain places. So the hype has been through the goddamn roof, and I went into this expecting like the best horror movie ever made, something like I was like, this is going to be amazing. And now that my expectations are sort of like in check, I kind of want to watch it again and be like, oh, I like this a lot more than I'm not, now that I'm not expecting something. But
yeah. I suspect we'll both like it more on rewatch, and maybe, you know, anybody who liked the movie will like it more on rewatch, just because, yeah, like you said, it's removed from that expectation level. Another thing that now I'm kind of thinking through is like, Kiernan Shipka's character, I think her name is Carrie Ann Camera or something along those lines, right?
Yeah.
She is in this this facility, and then Longlegs goes to visit her. We don't see this interaction happen in the movie. And then Lee Harker's character goes to visit her the next day. And I guess now I'm kind of wondering, like, was that just supposed to be some sort of red herring or something? Like, what, and why? Yeah. Why did her character, she's a survivor of, you know, her family, the patriarch of her family killed every other family member.
That's the other thing. I'll let you finish, but go on. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm not really sure I understand the point of that character now that we have this reveal of what's really going on.
And speaking of that, like, how do these goddamn dolls work? Because in the flashback scenes to Carrie Ann Camera's family, we see like her mother like stabs the doll. And at one point the dad is sitting with the doll on his lap. It's like, why are they doing that? Like, I don't understand why they're doing, like, why does the mom stab the doll? First of all, that makes absolutely no sense within the logic of the movie where these doll, like, what? I don't like, it just looks like these are things that they threw in the movie because they look creepy. And I'm sorry, but that's like, that's cheating. you can't just be like, you know, it'd be like, you know, it'd be creepy if a clown showed up. Like, you can't, like, that's lazy, man. You gotta put more thought into it than that. And like, the Carrie Ann Camera character serves absolutely no purpose in the movie. Like, she has her one scene, and Kiernan Shipka is really good in that scene, even though she's like talking like Gollum. For some reason, I don't like, or she's like Trixie. It's like, why is she talking like God? But then like, she like throws herself off a roof and we never see her again. It's like, what, why? I just don't.
Yeah.
I don't want to be this guy. I don't want to be this nitpicky nerd guy who just can't sit back and enjoy something, because I can, but it's, I don't know, man, just something about this stuff. It's like, it just doesn't add up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I have certainly been that guy on many occasions on this podcast, you know, much to my own chagrin, because I hate being that guy as well. But I don't know, there's something about like when a movie is so great at doing so many things, and then there are things that sort of stick out like a sore thumb, it's kind of like, well, you're clearly great at filmmaking and like making great decisions. So why is it that I'm bumping up against this particular decision that you made? So sometimes it's like, it's more obvious when it's within a movie that the rest of it is great, you know, where there's something that sticks out like that. So, anyway, I don't know, maybe on rewatch, we'll have more clarity about the purpose of the Carrie Ann Camera character and some of the stuff that we have questions about. But, I think this is a valuable conversation to have after one viewing, and cause I'm guessing a lot of people are probably having some of these thoughts at least. So, I'm glad we could sort of give a voice to some of it along the way. So, all right, let's take a break and then we'll come back and get into what else we've been watching.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
All right, Chris, I watched two movies. I had a double feature the other night. Both movies are on Amazon Prime Video right now. White Lightning from 1973 and Gator from 1976. Have you seen these Burt Reynolds?
I know of them, but I've never seen them.
Yeah, the character of Archer in the animated TV series Archer loves these movies. That's not exactly why I watch them, but they've been on my list for a long time. Burt Reynolds is just like a really interesting movie star. Like the fact that he was, you know, like one of the biggest movie stars in the world at a certain time is just kind of wild when you think about his whole persona and sort of what the modern standard movie star qualities are and just like how different he is from anything modern. He's just very, very, a very unique individual. White Lightning is basically, I like the first movie a lot better than the second film. Gator is, it came out 3 years after and Burt Reynolds directed Gator. He plays a character named Gator McCluskey, and it's like this good old Southern boy. He's been arrested in the first movie for like running moonshine, and the United States government comes in and is like, hey, we'll let you out of prison if you can basically like point the finger and give us some evidence at this corrupt sheriff in a small town who is ruling with an iron fist and running whiskey and moonshine through the town and all this stuff. And this corrupt sheriff happened to be responsible for the death of Burt Reynolds' character's brother. So he has like a personal stake in it. So it's kind of like Escape from New York or something, except in the South and like in cars instead of, you know, like a futuristic kind of Snake Plissken vibe. But, you know, there's some really cool car chases and stuff like that, especially in this first movie. Hal Needham was the second unit director, and he was like a stunt guy, and you can definitely tell they were like driving around real cars. I mean, this is definitely like pre-CG in any sort of meaningful way. Yeah. And so it feels dangerous, like a lot of those movies from that period really did. And so there's some good stuff. I would recommend checking out White Lightning. I would say stay really far away from Gator. It is just terrible. And it's like not fun at all, because the plot of Gator is years later, he is basically trying to take down a different crime boss who used to be an old friend of his. But this crime boss is profiting from a child prostitution ring. So it's just really kind of depressing and like sad. And Burt Reynolds is not having like the fun. There's no like a gleam in his eye like there was in the first movie, and I think it's partially because he directed the second film. And I think there's a part on the Wikipedia page where Burt Reynolds says they sent him the script for the film and he refused to do it, saying it's a terrible script. Then they asked me if I wanted to direct it, and I said it's a wonderful script. So that absolutely did not change the quality of the script at all, and the story really, really suffers as a result. I'm sure Burt Reynolds had fun making a movie or whatever, but like this is not a fun movie to watch. So yeah, I would say stay away from Gator. White Lightning. Steven Spielberg was originally going to direct White Lightning, so it's kind of interesting to watch through that lens as well. Yeah, maybe worth checking out if you're interested in that sort of like that whole like good old boy Southern period that like spawned stuff like, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard and all of that. If you're into any sort of those car stunts and things like that, might be worth checking out.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Orson Welles' movie The Trial from 1962?
I have. Criterion just put this out, and I watched it via the Criterion disc. And I don't know if you found this to be true, but I was shocked at how like funny this movie is. And yeah, like I was not expecting it to be like funny, and it's like a legitimately funny movie.
It is, yeah. Anthony Perkins plays the main guy, who is just this bureaucrat who wakes up and there's a cop in his room, and the guy's like, you're under arrest. And Anthony Perkins' character is basically like, what did I do? What is the crime? And the cop's like, well, it's not really my place to say. You'll have to submit to interrogation and just go through the process. And the whole movie is just this series of frustrating bureaucracy levels where this accused man is going through and trying to get answers about what the hell he's even been accused of and what is going on and what his punishment is supposed to be. And like, he's trying to find a lawyer and trying to like basically like go through the proper steps to fight back against a system that is built to just oppress people. And like there is no way to win against these people, basically. So I really ended up liking this movie a lot. It's kind of bleak at times, but it also is very funny. So what did you think about this overall, Chris, when you watched it?
Yeah, I really like this. I've never read the Kafka story. I'm sorry to say, but I thought it was just a hoot. I mean, it's really stylish. It's got this like almost like German expressionist sort of quality to it, and like a almost like a noirish sort of lighting sort of thing going on. And but what I really like about this is sort of the way Anthony Perkins plays the character. He almost plays the character as if he knows he's guilty, even though he doesn't know what he's being charged with. Mm-hmm. He plays the character as like a guilty man, and that's sort of what makes it very funny, because he's like, it's like stuttering and stammering his way through the movie. He's just like really nervous. He's got this like nervous energy. It's a very funny performance. So I really like this a lot.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't really think about that, because I feel like if you were truly innocent, there would be a lot more like righteous anger. And he gets into that at some points in this movie. But he also has this sense of like, all right, I better follow the rules here and go along with it. And there's almost a sense that like maybe he can subvert things, or like bribe his way out of different situations if he just gets in touch with the right person, and that person really never comes along. So yeah, it's a really interesting movie. Orson Welles has a small supporting role in the film, but Perkins is just great in this. And yeah, the direction, there's like some of the production design, there's that part where he Anthony Perkins' character works in this building that is like, I don't know where they filmed this, but it looked like some bombed out like real building in Europe somewhere. And it reminds me of the scene in The Apartment where I think it's Jack Lemmon's character is working in this office building, and there's just like rows and rows and rows of people just sitting there in desks, yeah, typing and everything. And there's a very similar type of look and vibe to Anthony Perkins' character's workplace in this movie. That just, you can tell it's all done practically, and like they just literally got like hundreds of people to sit at desks and type and like create this visual that is very, very stunning. So there's a lot of really cool imagery in this movie. So yeah, it's called The Trial from 1962, and it is available on the Criterion Collection right now. They're a Criterion channel, rather. Lastly, I rewatched U.S. Marshals from 1998. We've been talking a lot about The Fugitive this year, Chris. I think we talked about it in like an early episode this year, and then I interviewed the director, and you and me and Jacob talked about how great The Fugitive is. And U.S. Marshals was on TV the other day, and my wife and I were just like, oh, it's been a long time since we've seen this. I didn't really remember anything about it. Let's check this out. And it is trash. It is so, so bad. I did not remember how much of a gigantic step down in quality this was. The entire time I was watching it, I just could not stop thinking about like, man, they really must have paid Tommy Lee Jones just an astronomical sum of money to come back and be in this movie, because the script is so bad compared to the original film. Like the Fugitive is arguably a perfect movie, and this U.S. Marshals is just like riddled with just absolute terrible decisions, like from start to finish. And even the filmmaking is bad too. Like Stuart Baird directed this, and you, sir, are not an action movie director. I'm sorry to say. Like, yeah, he's primarily an editor, and that makes sense. But like, even the editing in this movie is bad. I mean, he didn't edit this film, but like, Jesus Christ, I was so like legitimately shocked at how terrible U.S. Marshals was. I don't know if you have any memories of this movie. I'm sure it's not one that's like regularly in your rotation, but have you seen this?
Yeah, I've seen it. I haven't seen it in years. I'm not going to be like, no, it's good, because it's not. And I think like Robert Downey Jr. is okay in it, like playing, yeah, like the secret bad guy. But other, yeah, than that, it's just like, it's stupid. It's not like, it doesn't feel anything like The Fugitive. Like, besides the fact that it has a bunch of the characters from The Fugitive in it, it feels absolutely nothing like The Fugitive.
Yeah. And there are moments where, like, Tommy Lee Jones at one point is, what's his name? Wesley Snipes' character escapes from a plane crash, and it's very similar to the big set piece in The Fugitive. And Tommy Lee Jones' character, who's this U.S. Marshal, Deputy Marshal Sam Girard is gathered around, you know, all these like police officers, who these local cops who are examining the crime scene and everything. And he realizes that Wesley Snipes' character has gotten away, and he goes, "We've got a fugitive." And it's just like, oh my God, I can't believe that you actually let that through. Like, this is just so bad. It's so clearly like trying to remind people of a better movie. And yeah, just a really, really poor experience all around. So U.S. Marshals, don't watch it. okay, what have you been watching, Chris?
So I watched a terrible, terrible movie called Boa versus Python, and I had a lot of fun. This is currently streaming on Tubi, so you can watch it for free with ads if you want. And I actually would recommend watching this. It's the best kind of bad movie, where you can tell like the people making it are really trying, and they're kind of having a good time. Like, there are bad movies where you're just like, oh, this is fucking unwatchable. And this is not like that. Like, you can actually like enjoy yourself watching it. So the premise of this is there's this like millionaire guy who owns casinos, and he's always smoking a cigar, and he's always has his shirt off. He's like got like a six pack. And there's one point where he's like on his own private plane, and the plane has like stone pillars inside of it and like a bathtub. And it's like, this is not a plane. Anyway, so he gets this giant python. I mean, giant, like Godzilla sized python. And the plan is he's going to have a bunch of like hunters pay him to hunt the python. But the python gets loose and starts killing people. And so the FBI learns about this. So they go to this scientist who has bred an equally big boa constrictor. And the plan is to get the boa constrictor to hunt down the python. And meanwhile, the casino guy and all the hunters are also gathering up to hunt down the python too. And there's this amazing scene where they introduce all the hunters. And there's like this one guy is from Texas, and he has like a giant American flag on his truck. And he drives up, and the casino guy introduces them one by one. And he's like, "This is my friend Tex." And there's like a guitar riff. And then like, there's like this other guy who's like a bow hunter. And like, he comes like out of the woods with like his bow and arrow. And it's just like, it's so good. Also, the movie is set in Philadelphia, but they shot it in Bulgaria, and it really shows. So it's just like, I don't know. I had so much fun watching it. Like, my girlfriend actually recommended this, because she had seen it years ago. And she was like, "Have you ever seen this movie?" Because she really likes to watch like bad monster movies. And she was like, "Have you ever seen this?" And I was like, "No." And she was like, "We should watch this." And I watched, and I was just like, this is just a blast from beginning to end. Like,
yeah. This movie is very special in my life, actually.
You've seen this? Oh, my God. I'm so happy you've seen this. Great.
I watched it one time, or maybe twice, in 2004, which was when I was in college. I graduated in 2004 and started college, like, whatever that was, late 2004, early 2005. And so, this movie, my roommate, he and I were watching this film, and he invited a girl over to watch Boa versus Python with us for their first date. And now they're married, and I was the best man at their wedding. So, like, and I think Boa versus Python factored into their wedding in some way. Like, they mentioned it in like a speech to the entire crowd or something. Like, you know, the fact that she stuck through it with him after watching Boa versus Python for date number one says a lot about her character. And yeah. So the fact that, this movie, I think it was a sci-fi original movie or something, like, or it aired on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah,
Yeah, just a really, really special film. I want to say a snake sexually assaults somebody in this movie.
That does happen. That's probably the least enjoyable part of the movie. I wish they had cut that out, because it's not like overly graphic, but it's like, this probably should not be in the movie. But this movie was... This movie was made in 2004. That was a different era.
A much different era, yes.
But God, like, there's this woman. She's like a scientist. I don't even know what her job is. She's an expert on snakes. No, she hates snakes. I don't know why. I don't know why they recruit her, because she hates snakes. But they introduce her at like a swimming pool. And there's a part where she's just like, "I can hold my breath underwater." And this actually plays into the movie. So props to the screenwriter for including this. But this huge muscular guy shows up and he's like, I bet I can hold my breath longer than you. And there's this entire sequence where they're in a swimming pool trying to hold their breath. And she makes him freak out by pretending she's going to like untie her bikini top. And like his eyes are like bugging out of his head. And it's just like, it's like, oh, this is so stupid. And I love every last minute of it. So other than the sexual assault via snake, I really recommend Boa versus Python.
Yeah, and that's a very quick scene, so yeah. They don't really linger on it or anything. Okay, what else have you been watching, Chris?
I just watched Tarot, whatever how you say it. How do you say it?
Tarot.
Yeah. Have you seen this, Ben? Did you see Tarot?
No.
Yeah, so I just watched this bad movie, but you know what? It wasn't terrible. It's a very generic card, especially like a Final Destination movie where with tarot cards, like it's about these college kids and they get their whatever horoscope read by this fellow classmate via tarot cards. And the cards predict how they're going to die. And you know what? This is like, as poor a movie this is, it's got like some style to it. And the monsters are really well designed. So I didn't have like a bad time watching this. It's not good. But like there's the dialogue is really bad. There's a part where like one of the guys gets killed and the woman who read the tarot cards is like, he was an earth sign and they found him in the dirt. And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. So, you know, it's not boring. So that's something. So tarot, it's okay. It's not tarot, good.
Not terrible.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Also, the movie was originally called Horror Scope, and they really should have kept that title because that's
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Where did you watch this? Is it like streaming somewhere?
I got sent the Blu-ray. So, okay. But it is on digital, so you can probably rent it if you're so inclined.
Okay. All right. So the last movie that you wanted to talk about is something that I've never seen. Tell me about this.
Yes. So as you know, and as everyone else knows, over the weekend, someone tried to assassinate Donald Trump. And I won't get too much into that because I don't want to cause a ruckus or anything like that. But when that happened, I immediately thought of this movie from 1992 called Bob Roberts, which is a fake documentary directed by Tim Robbins. And before I go any further, I want to add, I do not think the assassination attempt against Donald Trump was staged. I'm not like a crazy person who was just like, he did this to draw up support. Like, I don't think that's what happened. I think this is a real event. It's a serious thing. Someone actually got killed. That's a terrible thing. You know, I'm not trying to downplay that. But in Bob Roberts, there's a plot point where this character who is a guy running for Senate in Pennsylvania stages his own assassination to drum up support, and it helps him in the polls. So that's sort of what reminded me to watch this. But beyond that, this is an excellent movie. It's also like disturbing how prophetic this was. This came out in 1992, and ultimately this is a movie about a conservative millionaire who presents himself as a conservative rebel. And look, there's no such thing as a conservative rebel. It's an oxymoron. You cannot be a conservative and be a rebel. If you're a conservative, you are the opposite of a rebel. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. But he sells himself as a folk singer. He sings these folk songs, and the songs are really catchy, but they're really disturbing when you listen to the lyrics, like, because they're all about like executing drug dealers and like all, you know, stuff that conservatives, you know, stuff that like really right-wing people are all in on, you know, but he's able to become very popular through this message with the help of the media, who find him very entertaining. There's a scene where he goes on a show that's meant to be Saturday Night Live, and the cast has a problem with him being there because they know he's like a fascist conservative, but he's trying to get this image as this like, you know, fun guy. And it's like, and Tim Robbins plays the character, his name is Bob Roberts, even though he's not Trumpian in that he's like, he doesn't act like Trump, it very much feels like Tim Robbins really predicted Trump. And it makes the movie like the movie has always been chilling in a way, though, that it sells this character, but it's like extra chilling now that we live in a world where Donald Trump is a real person and he'll probably win the election again. And boy, is that terrifying. So This movie, it's not streaming anywhere. I actually own it on DVD. I bought the DVD from Hollywood Video when Hollywood Video went out of business. That's how long I've had this DVD.
Wow.
So I don't even know if you can rent it anywhere. But it's an excellent movie. It has an amazing cast. Alan Rickman is in it. Alan Rickman plays the campaign advisor, and it turns out he was like a member of the CIA. So there's this whole subplot about how the CIA is propping up Bob Roberts and getting him to, you know, run for office. I'm looking at the cast right now. Giancarlo Esposito is in this. John Cusack, Susan Sarandon, James Spader, Fred Ward, great character actor who's not with us anymore. Tom Atkins, another great character actor. David Strathairn, Helen Hunt is in this. All these people in it. And a lot of them, they're only in it for like one scene because they just show up in like brief. But this movie is so good. I really recommend it if you can find it somewhere. I would really worth checking. Oh, Jack Black is in this also, which is ironic because Jack Black is in headlines right now because of the whole Trump assassination attempt with Kyle Gass said on stage and all that stuff. So
yeah,
just it's very odd how life reflects art and so on like that.
Yeah, and I think Tim Robbins made some statement about like basically what you said at the beginning of talking about this, like, you know, the assassination attempt was a very real thing, and you know, people drawing comparisons shouldn't be basically becoming conspiracy nuts or anything like that.
Yeah, so, like, it's one thing to be like, oh, that reminds me of Bob Roberts. It's another thing to be like, this is happening exactly like Bob Roberts and it's real. Like, no, yeah. It's one thing, like, this reminded me of Bob Roberts, but I'm not saying it's the same thing. Like, it's not. It's obviously not.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I'll have to try to check that out if I can track down a copy of it. It sounds like kind of tough to watch these days. So, all right. I wanted to mention real quick in the what we've been playing section, I've been listening to the vinyl scores of Coco and Up from Mondo. Mondo restocked a few of its vinyl scores recently, including these soundtracks, both of which were composed by Michael Giacchino. And they sent me copies to check out. And man, they're just gorgeous. The cover of Coco, especially, is so vibrant and colorful that I actually plan to display it in my living room in the fall season because it has Miguel, the hero of Coco, joyously playing guitar in this pile of orange and red and yellow leaves. And it's just beautiful to look at. So I spoke a lot about the Up score on the episode of the podcast where I interviewed Giacchino recently, so I won't really go long or anything on that, but that score remains fantastic. And then as far as Coco goes, I have only seen that movie like once or twice, and the actual songs for Coco, which are on this soundtrack, work better for me while watching the movie. Like, I don't really think I'm going to be making it a habit to fire up Remember Me while I'm making dinner because it's just like an emotional song and it doesn't really make sense for me to listen to that out of context. But the second album, both of these are like double LPs or whatever. The second album in the Coco set is instrumental and it's like much more moody and it has this great vibe to it. So that one is much more likely to be in my regular rotation as like just a sort of mood music type of scenario. So check out, I put links in the show notes if you want to see the artwork, if you want to go to Mondo's website and see if that might be something that you're interested in getting for yourself, the scores of Coco and Up. Okay, you can find more about all of the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for today's episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about this show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.